Well, it's a delight to be with you tonight. We're grateful for those that have come to visit. We're thankful because you encourage the church here, I know, and you encourage me. It's good to see Brother and Sister Goff in the audience. We've been friends for a long, long time, and I appreciate them so much, what they've meant to my life, my wife's life, and our son. Now that I passed down from Arkansas or Oklahoma to come back to Texas, I try to make them my stop place, and that's where I'll spend the night and get to visit and catch up, and it's just always a joy to be with them. In fact, Sister Goff thought that I was going to come spend the night with them for this trip, and I thought, well, I love y'all, but that's, you know, that's about 100 miles out of the way, but no, I make that opportunity as much as I can. Good to see the Lamberts, of course, their daughter and son-in-law, and enjoyed being with them. Known Roger and Dorinda both a long, long time. We go back to stories in the past, so it's good to be with them. Good to see the Calverts here, others in the audience. Thank you for coming our way. When I send my meetings, always, you know, I'm the same way at home. We kind of want to print up something that has a topic so we can invite people. And I always ask the guy, I said, don't hold me to stone. And so lately I've just been sending alternates. I'll pick the five or six that have been on the length of the sermon or the meetings, and I'll pick them out, and then I'll give like three or four alternates. And I'll say, if one of these sounds better to you, the needs that you have, and Zach quickly filled this one in. He said, because I've got young ones that are going to come up, I want to hear this lesson. I said, well, it's a lesson I like to preach. It just depends on the audience. I can't preach it every place and be as effective, but obviously you have young ones here, and we're all concerned about our young people. When I look at the statistics, I ran across this statistic when I was originally doing this lesson, and I don't know how we would decide how many of our young people don't come back to the Lord. The evangelical community, probably the closest in the denominational world that we would have some affinity to, and by that I mean they still believe that the Word of God is plenarily inspired by God. Every word is spoken by Him and came from Him. They believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God. Those are basic, that He was rose from the dead, the basic kinds of things that we would still have agreement with. But among their kids, the kind of statistics that they will do, almost two out of three of their kids do not come back to church, as we would say. They grow up and they never attend or go anywhere again. I know that there are a lot of families in the places where I've preached, where I know specifically where I am right now. It's just, it's painful sometimes. It's almost too painful to preach a lesson like this at my home congregation, because I stare into the faces of people, literally, folks, that none of their children are faithful. None. Nobody serves God. It's not even that you could say, I have one. I have one that follows God. Would still be a blessing, would still be something that you could hold on to. And I mean not to cause pain to anyone. That's our lesson tomorrow night. It is a lesson that I've preached as I've gotten older about parents that have children that have gone away and are lost from God. And so that's what he meant by that we're going to talk about different groups of people. But tonight we want to think about young people, and we want to think about the reasons why young people go away from the Lord. The first lesson that I would think that generally we're going to approach with anybody is that they do not know who Jesus is. And what do I mean by that? They've not come to accept him as he presented himself to us. In John, the sixth chapter, if you will, look with me at those passages that are there at the end of that account. And it says to us at verse 66, and after this, many of his disciples, because of the things that he had said, you remember previous to this, they grumbled against him and said, these are hard things to understand. And after this, when he said what he had to say to them, many of his disciples turned back and no longer walked with him. Folks, that's as old as the Bible, isn't it? It's as old as the New Testament, of people not walking with Jesus when they do not like what he says. So Jesus said to the 12, "Do you want to go away as well?" And Simon Peter answered him, saying, "Lord, to whom shall we go? You have the words of eternal life, and we have believed and have come to know that you are the Holy One of God." And Jesus said to them, "Did I not choose you, the 12?" And we could read the rest of that. It has a terrible prediction about Judas Iscariot. But the phrase that I'm interested in here is what Simon Peter says to him, "Lord, to whom shall we go? You have the words of eternal life, and we have come to know that you are the Holy One of God." The very first thing I would say, not only about a young person, but anyone who walks away from God, is that they do not know who the Lord is. They've forgotten the most basic thing that we can talk about when we talk about Jesus Christ, is that he came from God, that he is the God-man on this earth, that he is our mediator, and all of that was proven by his resurrection. Sometime in March or April, in this time of the year, Jesus arose from the tomb. I mean, I know that people celebrate the celebration of Easter, and we don't know exactly when that day would have fallen, but it fell sometime in this month because of the Jewish calendar between March and April. So every year as March and April come around, people may celebrate Easter, but you and I really celebrate it every first day of the week. We come to take the Lord's Supper declaring that Jesus is not in the tomb, that he arose and that he ascended and that he's at the right hand of the throne of God. But we have to get our young people to do the kind of work that they believe that with all of their heart, soul, and mind. You have to do your homework. I can't help you to do that. I can point you. I can show you the arguments, but I'm saying that you have to make that certain in your own heart. And why people walk away from the Lord is that at some point they have quit believing that. Folks, all of us are going somewhere in life. And when somebody decides to walk away from the Lord, what path? Where does that road go? Sometimes they're not thinking about it. They're not thinking about how hard it's going to be and what's going to be at the end of it. But they better, because if they leave the Lord, that road's going somewhere. And if you go with the Lord, that road is going somewhere too. It's going to the blessing that will be with him forever and ever in the place that he's prepared for us in heaven. When we think about Jesus, we have to make up our mind that he is who he claimed to be. And so at the very outset, it has to be that I believe he has the authority to rule in my life. I remember years ago, D. Bowman telling me the story that he was flying back in the gospel meeting. And he was reading his Bible, and a stewardess was going by, or a flight attendant was going by, and she saw him reading, and they didn't have a lot of folks aboard, and she had a little bit of time, and she just said, can I talk to you for just a second? And because she saw that he was reading the Bible, she wanted to know about something that was going on in her life. And this other flight attendant kept going by, and she heard, she was listening to the conversation. Finally, Dee said that this other person just sort of butted in and said, "Nobody's going to tell me how to live my life." I mean, Jesus gets into our face, doesn't he? I mean, sooner or later, you've got to encounter Jesus. Nobody's going to say in America, "I didn't ever know about Jesus." I mean, he's everywhere. And there's John 3:16 on fence posts. There's Jesus on almost any place somebody goes. The Bible's everywhere. Somebody can have access to it if they want. They're going to have to make up their mind, and most people just reject him outright, like that lady just saying, "I'm not going to allow him to rule in my heart." But the authority, the idea of authority, is that you have the right and the power to rule in the life of someone. And that's because Jesus is our creator. He spoke, John tells us in chapter 1, that all things came into existence by him. He spoke all things into existence. The Godhead is our creator, but Jesus was the mouthpiece. I mean, when he said, "Let man be created," he created him. And he alone has answers to all the questions that we have in life, where we came from and why we are here, what should we be doing while we're here, and where are we going? Where is that path leading to us? Folks, authority is written almost on every page of the Bible. In Acts chapter 5, verse 29, Peter answered those people that were the leading the Sanhedrin, "We ought to obey God rather than man." You and I have to make up our minds. We're going to follow the government that may say that they're opposed to Jesus. If we had grown up under a communist regime, that we couldn't worship God. We couldn't worship Jesus. You have to make up your mind who has the ultimate authority. My favorite story about authority is about a governor running for re-election. He had stumped all over the state that day. He ended up at a rally that featured a barbecue dinner, and he was famished. He hadn't eaten anything all day. So as he made his way through the line, he came to the place where they were serving the barbecue chicken, and being famished, he asked for two pieces. And the lady informed him that they were giving one piece of chicken to everybody coming through the line. Well, he didn't want to throw his weight around, but he was hungry, and so he looked at the server and said, "Ma'am, do you know who I am? I'm the governor of this state." And she simply replied to him. She said, "Mister, do you know who I am? I'm the lady in charge of the chicken, and you get one piece." That's always my favorite story about the right to rule, right? The authority and the power to rule. Why does God have that authority or power? Well, some of you know, some of you may not know, I'm a beekeeper. I was a beekeeper until I had a reaction here about a year ago, so I had to give it up. But this is a frame of bees that are going to hatch out. That brown section in the middle, she's laid an egg, and all those holes that are capped, the ones you see that aren't, most likely they're beginning to hatch out. The stuff at the top, I forget I have a pointer, is honey, so they can feed the brood before they cap it. These are all baby bees that are going to hatch out. This is what the sections, if you were to cross-section all of this, would have looked like. These are tiny little eggs that every one of those holes she goes to and lays, deposits an egg. And then in 3 days, it falls over and it starts the larva stage. And they feed it at first what is called royal jelly. You may have seen that in stores that you can buy, and people tout its properties. You can take it in pill form and other things. But anyway, this is going to develop into a pupa eventually, and then into an adult bee that'll hatch out. What I'm fascinated by, though, is what shape is that? What shape are all those cells? They're hexagons. If you look really carefully, they're hexagons. You notice where NASA and the music industry gets that same, why you'll see that same pattern used. Why is that? I didn't know there was a word for it, but I was preaching where Brent Moody's a preacher, and his wife's a really smart lady, math lady. She told me the word is tessellation. I said, "Wow, that's a fancy word I didn't know existed, tessellation." It means what shape will occupy the most spaces on a plane. I mean, if you thought about circles, if I drew circles and then I put a circle down here, you'd lose that funny little triangle, wouldn't you? You'd have all that wasted space. If I put pentagons on there, if I put something else, you're not going to have as many shapes. They would all stick, or maybe an octagon, they would all stick together like that, you wouldn't have as many. A hexagon is the only shape that will give you the most holes on a plane and also the strongest structure possible. Because three sides of one, as you can see in this, are three sides of the other. And three sides of the bottom that are shaped that same way are three sides of the bottom on the other side. It uses the least amount of material to make the strongest structure possible to occupy the most on a plane. Now, if you believe evolution, Darwinian evolution, at some point, first of all, solitary bees decided to work together. In a complicated, folks, when I would crack open a hive and smell that sweet smell that still resonates in my mind, and I began to take it apart frame by frame and look and try to find her, because she is the most important one. If anything's wrong with her, that hive's in trouble. And just see if everything's going well, and you look from frame to frame, and you think about the complicated, or rather complex life that is going on inside of that hive, what has to take place. And I think about on the most basic plane, somebody got together and decided, you know what, let's vote. I think we're going to do hexagons. Hexagons will be the best thing. You know the circle, squares, you could do all the things. Where did that come from? And why would it be the most efficient? It's like a great mind was deciding. and long ago put inside little bee brains, the fact that you can take any honeybee, and if they make that comb in a tree, they're going to make it the same way. It may hang down in a U shape, but it's going to have that same tessellation. It's going to occupy the most spaces on a plane. Folks, it's stuff like this that we need to show our kids, and we need to talk to them, we need to build into them that there is a God, and no one else would have, I mean, there's no way that chance, blind chance, would have decided these things. Psalms 19 and verse 1, the heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament shows his handiwork. So when I think about Jesus Christ, I think about choosing the right one to serve, right? In Joshua 24, verse 15, Joshua long ago said to those people, choose for yourselves this day whom you will serve, whether the gods which your fathers served that were on the other side of the river, or the gods of the Amorites in whose land you dwell. But as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. And folks, we will all serve somebody. There's no such thing as absolute freedom. In Romans 6, verse 16, do you not know that to whom you present yourselves slaves to obey, you are that one slaves whom you obey, whether sin leading to death or obedience leading to righteousness. There are only two choices. And you're going to be the slave of one or the other. There's no such thing as absolute freedom. When college students come to college, I would always tell them when we're talking about this sort of thing, I said, you know what? I bet your parents gave you one of three options. I said, go to college, go to trade school, or get a J-O-B. I give a fourth option to mine. I said, you can go live with the grandparents. But you ain't living here anymore. If you don't have a J-O-B, you're not going to trade school, or you're not going to college. You're free, right? You're absolutely free. You can do whatever you want to. And nobody, whatever you please, can tell you no. You have a car payment. You have insurance. You have rent, taxes, utilities, gasoline, school expenses. Are there still laws to uphold the city, state, and national government? No money is absolutely free. And it doesn't matter what society, it doesn't matter how primitive some society is, no one is absolutely free. And that's the point that Paul's making to us. When we serve spiritually, it is no different. We either are slaves unto sin or we are slaves unto righteousness. And we need to get our young people to see that most basic argument. Secondly, young people leave God the way other people leave God, and that is because sin is fun. What do I mean by that? Well, I think about the passage in Hebrews 11 that tells about Moses. By faith, Moses, when he became of age, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter. Can you imagine the wealth that was at his disposal? I always think about the power and all just, I mean, when we unearth the things in Egypt and see how wealthy they are in this day and age, when Tutankhamun's tomb was unearthed in the 20s, or King Tut, as he's referred to, and all that wealth is seen. He was a minor pharaoh, folks. And yet the wealth of Egypt was phenomenal. What was at Moses' disposal? Choosing between those two lifestyles. Choosing rather to suffer affliction with the people of God than to enjoy the passing pleasures of sin. Esteeming the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures in Egypt, for he looked to the reward. That's looking down the road. That's looking down the road of Egypt and saying, I choose not Egypt with all its wealth and all that it can give me from a worldly standpoint. I choose to be with the slaves of Egypt, with God's people, because he looked to the reward. He judged at the end of it. Years ago, there was a book written by a social scientist, Walter Mischel, called The Marshmallow Test. Are you familiar with that? I wasn't until just a few years ago. Somebody presented this, and I went out and looked it up. And sure enough, in the 60s, I think it was in the 1960s, he and his team of researchers who were college students did tests with young kids. I forget exactly what age, but something like third grade, fourth grade. And what they did simply was that they went in a room and they took, you see, two marshmallows, the big ones, get those real big ones. And they put one marshmallow in front of every kid on their desk. And the teacher said to them, looked at them and said, if you will wait, I'm going to leave the room. I've got to go do some things in the office. If you will wait and not eat this marshmallow, when I get back, I'll give you another marshmallow just like it, and then you can eat both of them. But you have to not eat this marshmallow until I get back and give you the other marshmallow. And then she left the room. And so what they found out was that some kids are the kind of kids that immediately, they just stuffed it in their mouth. I'm not looking at anybody. Other kids would wait for a little bit, but then they would eventually give in and eat it. But other kids sat there patiently and did not eat the marshmallow until she came back and she did exactly what she said. To each of those kids, she gave another marshmallow, and now they could eat too. Then what they did was phenomenal. They followed those kids through the rest of their life. They had to take this test on the next 30 years. They followed these young kids into young adulthood when they had families and careers and all that, and put together this book. And guess what they found out? The ones that waited, the ones that exercise what it says, why self-control is the engine of success, what the Bible has taught and taught and taught, what people did when they would just not give in and hold themselves back, were more successful in life. They did better in their careers. They had happier marriages and families. Everything about them was better. Isn't that an amazing story? What is the story of Moses? Is someone able to control themselves and say, I will not partake of all the passing pleasures of sin because I look to the reward of what's coming in eternity, even if I must suffer greatly because of that. When you look at liquor and drugs and sex, it all looks fun, doesn't it? Because it is. And just flat matter that we need to tell our young people, well, it is. That's exactly what Hebrews 11 said. To enjoy the passing pleasures of sin. These things would have no appeal to our young people unless they were fun. And so when I think about young people having to make up their minds, they need to look down the road. Yeah, I can go in to liquor and to drugs and to just sex with whoever and whenever when I want to. But what's the end of that road? Well, the writer of Proverbs tells us in Proverbs 7:22 about that young man who's enticed by a married woman and their husband has gone away. And just these two verses out of that chapter. All at once he follows her as an ox goes to the slaughter, or as a stag is caught fast till an arrow pierces its liver, as a bird rushes into a snare. He does not know that it will cost him his life. How many people do you know that have left their first mate, gone off with someone else, and have that attitude of looking elsewhere, that sort of attitude? How successful is that second marriage? You know how many second marriages fail compared to first marriages? Almost 90% of the second ones fail. You know how many third ones fail? I mean, it just goes up astronomically every time. Why wouldn't it be any other way? Because what the Bible's saying to us is, if somebody doesn't know how to exercise self-control with the first one, why are they going to find it on the third one? They do not know that it costs them their life, not only in things in this world, how we see people mess up so badly here and foul up in their lives, but spiritually, how terrible is it? In Proverbs 23, when he talks about drinking in verses 31 and 32, do not look at wine when it is red, when it sparkles in the cup and goes down smoothly. In the end, it bites like a serpent and stings like an adder. There's another story, right? Somebody getting drunk and then all the things that can happen when you do get drunk. Satan never tells you the whole story. He never told her that you could get pregnant the first time. He never told her that her boyfriend and his parents, who supposedly were Christians, would have nothing to do with her unless she got an abortion. The devil never told her that she'd be a single mom for 7 years rearing a son by herself without a dad. No, Satan never tells you that you can get venereal diseases, you can have all kinds of terrible things happen to you. Those things you never see on TV that just tout all this, the sins with drugs and sex and alcohol as if there's no consequences. I'll tell you about a consequence. When I preached in Longview, Texas many years ago, the end of the place where the kids started their drag strip, I don't know where they started. I don't know if the start was in the Walmart parking lot, you know, on the loop, the old Walmart, I don't even know if it's still there. Don't even know where it went to the other end, but I know that's where they always gathered. There was always a huge group out there. And one night there was a kid that was doped up and not only on drugs but on alcohol as well. And he got in his car and he drove into that group of young people. You would just always see them out. I mean, big group, their cars all around, they're milling. He drove into the group of that young people and he trapped a young man under his car and drug him out of that parking lot. And they went out on the loop in Longview and they went down until cars saw what was happening. They literally rammed his vehicle. The cars that tried to hope to save that kid's life literally rammed that guy and drove him off into the ditch until the police could get there. The boy was dead. Do you know what was left for months and months and months? Folks, I don't remember how long. It was awful to think about it. But there was a burn strip that started in the Walmart parking lot about this wide, and you could follow it out to where it entered the loop and then turned. And it went off down that loop until it went off in the ditch. And sun and rain and every ounce of weather did not erase it for months and months and months and months. My son was a little baby then. But I thought to myself, I said, if I had a preteen, if I had a teenager, we would just start in that parking lot and we'd just walk that strip. And I'd say nothing. And we'd walk and walk and follow it until we got to the end. And then the lecture. Folks, there's consequences. Do you know what that boy, where did that boy end up? The one that killed that boy. What happened to that family that lost that young lad? You can be at the wrong place at the wrong time. You can be doped up and do something that you never would have thought. The rest of your life, you're going to live with it. The consequences of it, if you do make your life better, are always going to be with you. Beware, sin is fun, but there's another road. A third reason that young people leave is because they make the wrong kinds of friends. 1 Corinthians chapter 15, 33 says what? Evil companionship corrupts good morals. Evil company corrupts good habits, whatever your version says. We can all quote it, but do we know it? Do we understand that there are friends that can lead us away from God? This passage in the Old Testament, Deuteronomy 13, verse 6 and 8. If your brother, the son of your mother, the son of your daughter, or the wife you embrace, or your friend who is as your own soul entices you secretly, saying, let us go and serve other gods. You shall not yield to him or listen to him. Your eyes shall not pity him. Nor shall you spare him, nor shall you conceal him. They were to take him out and stone him to death. And while that sounds awful when we think about it, the judgment hour, say, why is it so awful, folks? Because would any true friend try to kill us? This person is trying to lead you away from God, lead you into hell, lead you into real death, death that lasts forever and ever. What true friend would do that? But who our young people choose to follow, who our young people choose to be around, is going to have a huge influence and bearing on what they become in life. We need to be. Folks, families that I see that work really well, you know who their friends are? In a real way, their moms and dads are. Now, I realize they can't be exactly like. They need young people their age. I'm going to tell you, growing up like I did on a farm, my dad was a really good friend to me. I don't, I would say probably in those days, my best friend. I've had my son say that to me. Because we were always working together on a farm. We were always together with the goats or with the show pigs or whatever was going on. That process makes connections happen. And it doesn't have to be this thing where they come in and grunt at you or you know, you don't know what to do with them. We have to make those things happen as best we can and make sure we put them with young people, that they're going to be around the right kind of folks. You remember Amnon? You remember that terrible story? David would pay for what happened, that he committed the sin with Bathsheba. Amnon's friend was Jonadab. It said Amnon was a son of David, had a friend whose name was Jonadab, the son of Shimeah, David's brother. Now, Jonadab was a very crafty man. You remember what he set his friend up to do? And Amnon then despised Tamar and then eventually was killed by his own half-brother, the full brother to Tamar, Absalom, and all the horror that happened. All you could say because what? Yeah, a lot of reasons. But here's the chief one. He had the wrong friend. He had a friend that didn't tell him the truth, didn't say the right things to him, didn't lead him in the right way. You think about Rehoboam. Instead of turning to old men, who did he turn to? He turned to his foolish friends. That when the people came and said, lift the burdens that your dad put on us, Rehoboam said, go away and let me reason. Instead of reasoning, he listened to the old men, and they advised him to do that. But he rejected the advice which the elders had given him and consulted the young men that had grown up with him who stood before him. And he said, You think my dad was bad on you? My little finger's thicker than my dad's waist. Could not. The kingdom split and fell in two, and Rehoboam and all of his descendants paid for it. And partially you could say it was because of Rehoboam's foolishness to turn to his young friends, the wrong kind of friends, rather than to those who were wise in the ways of God. I think about young people that walk away from God. They do so like anyone else because they let this world choke out the word. As for what was sown among thorns, this is the one who hears the word, but the cares of this world and the deceitfulness of riches choke the word, and it proves unfruitful. You ever like passages you're reading and you come across one word or maybe a phrase, and I mean it just boom, choke. Man, that's a strong word. Same words used in Luke 8:42, and it says the multitudes were thronging about Jesus. Kind of envision that scene in this season's episode of Chosen when the lady came up to touch the hem of his garment, and they were all around him, just thronging him, choking him. Or in Luke 8, verse 33, it says when the pigs drowned in the sea, when they went over the cliff and drowned in the sea, that's the same word that's used here. That's a stout word. They choke the word, the thorns do. You want to know which one is my yard? What are you laughing about? I set that up, didn't I? That's my yard. But not much longer. My wife said, boy, they sprayed it, man. It's starting to die, so I'm hoping for this. But man, have you ever seen a weed? A weed can prosper in a crack in a sidewalk. If you plant a corn seed in a crack in a sidewalk, it might make a plant. It may make some grisly little tiny ear that'll never amount to anything. And a weed can prosper. Weeds have the ability to choke out. What he is saying to us is that, folks, so many of us are going to be lost at the end of time, not because we did a bunch of sinful, that is, overt, going out and drinking and boarding with women or men, depending on who we are, and all of that, allowing ourselves to be drawn away from God. Now, there will be most people who are just going to be drawn away because of the cares of this world, of the deceitfulness of riches. Choke people. I think of young people, I think, what was most important in your life? School? Money? Fun? My dad came back to God in his old age. I was there when he confessed his sin in a hospital bed. But for a lot of years, my dad and mom didn't serve God. I can remember, folks, when I went off to college, that my dad and mom looked at me and they said, don't you let church get in the way of you making good grades. You make good grades. And I didn't say anything to them, but I knew they were flat wrong. My grandparents, on the other hand, were telling me what I needed here spiritually. And I believed that. That grades had a place, and I do the best I can, but I'm going to work hard because we're going to put church first. We're going to put God first. I'm going to tell you, people are going to make that choice. It's either you choose the riches and the path of Egypt, or you choose God, and you make up your mind. And if you don't make it up right, you're going to look like the yard to the left and not the one to the right. And lastly, when I think about all of this, people leave God simply because they do not give him their all. Matthew 22, 36 and 37, he said to him, you shall love, to answer what is the greatest commandment, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind. This is the greatest commandment. Folks, we understand that. All of it. Every ounce of it. If I give him my all, he's going to be first. I have to make a decision to come to a gospel meeting or study because I've got a test the next day. I'm going to do both. I'm going to go to the gospel meeting. And then I'm going to study an extra hour if I have to stay up, or an extra 2 hours. But the decision is not going to be either or, that I'm going to give up the opportunity to serve God and make my decision based on that. Because if I make it then, if I make that little decision then, I'm going to tell you, there are going to come great decisions that you're going to make the wrong way. And it will cost you forever and forever. Y'all remember Hurricane Ike? It's my first hurricane. I grew up in West Texas. I was used to tornadoes and wind storms and hail storms. And I sometimes tell people, I said, have y'all seen the panhandle? I said, my kinfolks, my ancestors came across there in a covered wagon and said, hey, let's drop off here and make a living. This looks good. And I'm thinking, what were you thinking? And so the rest of life is tough. I never grew up around hurricanes, but boy, we watched that. Do you remember when it filled the Gulf? Hurricane Ike, at the time that it hit, was the third costliest hurricane in history that came out of the Gulf. It still is at the top of the list, somewhere very close to the top in Texas. But Harvey obviously exceeded it. But it's now like number 7. It's gone way down the list. But here's where I lived at the time. Here's Bryan, Texas. And that's where College Station was. So you can see, I was 100 miles to the coast. That eye was heading straight for us, it looked like. It turned and went up this way. So we got the wraparounds. I never had experienced that before. You go outside and there'd just be this whoosh, 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 and then it kind of calmed. And then here it come again, you know. That same kind of thing that you see when you're looking at a hurricane. But everybody that was in Galveston and Bolivar Peninsula and High Island and all those places along that Texas coast were warned to leave because you will face certain death. I can remember hearing that. If you stay, you're going to face certain death. And folks, there were people that stayed in spite of it. They said, we've ridden out other hurricanes. This ain't going to be any different. They were warned at the last minute. The lady whose neighbor stayed till the last minute and got off the island tried and begged her to go with them, and she said no. And while the cell phone towers were still up, before the winds knocked them down, she called them and she said, I think I've made a terrible mistake. They found her body 8 miles in after it was over. They didn't find a lot of them. The devastation, folks, was this. That coastline was covered with houses. I always tell people, I want to know who built that one. That's the guy that I want. I don't know why that is like that. That nobody had come back in and built yet, but boy, somebody must have made that out of concrete and everything else. But that's what the Gulf Line looked like. There was nothing left. You were dead. Why would people stay? Why would you hear that and not save yourself? This makes a great Wednesday invitation talk. Because that's exactly the point. Why would anybody hear the lesson tonight? Not because I've preached it, but the Word of God, and not do what God said to do. Because the same thing's coming out from God. Repent or be destroyed. Where did we come from? From God, the Father who made us, through the work of His Son. What should we be doing while we are here? Live our lives according to His holy word. Where are we going? Hopefully, to be with Him and home forever and ever. But there's another choice. And that choice leads to the place that God has prepared for the devil and his angels. Make up your mind. It's one or the other. If you're subject to heaven's invitation, come while together we stand and sing.